ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. 6 months ago, we invited Gavin Menzies, the author of 1421, The Year China Discovered America, to It's Rainmaking Time in a blockbuster understanding of how maybe, and in fact, our history has been told inaccurately. If you are a person who loves revisionist history and is excited about seeing new evidence for what we've learned in school as kids, welcome to the conversation. Gavin Menzies has also authored the book 1434, The Year a Magnificent Chinese Fleet Sailed to Italy and Ignited the Renaissance. Everything we've learned about the Renaissance is going to change in its context, its color, its flavor, its atmosphere. Because maybe Leonardo da Vinci owned a copy of DiGiorgio's treatise, Civil and Military Machines. Maybe Leonardo da Vinci was an illustrator rather than just an inventor. Also, we want to talk to Gavin Menzies about the lost treasures of Atlantis at the end of the show, which is just picked up by Orion and also by HarperCollins for Worldwide Rights. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome the man who's rocking the boat of history, Gavin Menzies, to It's Rainmaking Time. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me, Kim. I really enjoyed our last interview.
I enjoy all of our conversations because that's really what they are, aren't they, Gavin?
Yes, they're open inquiry conversations.
All right. I thought that 1421 was going to rock the boat of history, but now we have to face 1434. You're a man who has a background in the Navy. You have been a captain of a submarine. In 1953, you joined the Royal Navy.
Yes,
I want you to talk about how this work in the Navy impacted your navigation curiosity and also gave you expertise in which to look at things. Let's talk about that first as a context.
Well, thank you, Kim. As you say, I joined the Navy in 1953. I joined submarines in 1959 because in those days you could get to command young, in your late 20s. If you'd done 5 or 6 years in submarines and you passed the commanding officer's qualifying course, you could expect to command by the time you, certainly by the time you were 30, probably by the time you were 28. My first command was to HMS Rorqual, which was submarine based in the Far East. In those days, we had submarine bases all over the world. And whilst I was in Rorqual, sailed around most of the world, especially in the footsteps, as you might say, of Captain Cook and Magellan. Now, I found it very interesting indeed being able to see what they saw on their historic voyages. And what you see from a submarine periscope is quite different from what you see in a big ship high up. You see everything from about 10 foot above the sea. Now, the importance of that is that things appear different taken from that height. For example, if you have a group of islands with not very high islands at the front and the tall islands at the back, it can look like a solid block of land. And some of the earlier maps and charts which I looked at did show solid blocks of land where, in fact, there were groups of islands. And therefore, I could relate to that, and I learned how to construct maps and sea maps, charts, by using a periscope with not a particularly high height of eye. So it was very, very interesting. And then you had to, of course, always know your position quite accurately, because in a submarine, you could be far down below sea level. You could be several hundred feet below the sea. And, of course, if you got your navigation wrong, you might crash into the sea bottom. So that wouldn't be a good idea. So we learned quite a lot about practical navigation and about how to make maps. And I found that extremely useful when I came to write the book.
What led you to become interested in the Renaissance?
Complete accident. It wasn't really at all interested 4 years ago. And then in 2006, Marcella and I and a group of friends went to walk from southern Spain up the Via de la Plata That's the old historic silver route up to where the conquistadors came from in Extremadura. And we stopped at Toledo, which had been painted with such bravura by a Cretan artist. And whilst we were there, there was an exhibition on describing Leonardo's pumps, which had been used to bring water for the people of Toledo. And we went to this exhibition of Leonardo's work, and there was rather a curious section about pumps and hydraulic machines and so on. And it said in this section of the exhibition, we know that Leonardo da Vinci learned a great deal from Francesco di Giorgio about hydraulics for pumps and providing water for towns. Now, this came as a great surprise to me, because I'd always been taught Leonardo was the inventor. So why should he learn things from other engineers? And anyway, I hadn't the faintest idea who di Giorgio was. So when I got back to London, I looked up this chap di Giorgio in the British Library, and I found to my astonishment that he had apparently designed a whole range of machines, both civil and military, which Leonardo improved upon. And this was an astonishment. I thought to myself, well, it's really di Giorgio that should be getting all the credit. And I found that di Giorgio was just a small clerk in a mountain town. He'd never been to sea, never had a university education. So I thought, well, how on earth did he suddenly manage to design all these huge array of machines, cannons and water pumps and bazookas, God knows what he didn't design. And so I thought, well, did he actually design it all out of the blue? And how did he get his knowledge? And then I found that di Giorgio had, in fact, copied from a book which was published, or a series of books were published between 1433 and 1440 by another Italian called Tacola. And the story got even more bizarre, because Tacola was a clerk of works like di Giorgio. He'd never seen the sea, never been to university. But here he was, this unknown non-entity, designing parachutes, helicopters, submarines, underwater swimmers, cannons, bazookas, machine guns, machines for raising ships off the bottom, on and on and on, a huge panoply of new ideas. And I wondered if there was a link between Tacola, di Giorgio, and Leonardo, and I found there was. Basically, Tacola had written the first book.
The book that was copied from was called what?
Well, di Giorgio's was just called The Book of Military and Civil Machines. And the title was, in effect, adapted by Leonardo. But what had happened was that Tacola started it all off. He, apparently from nowhere, came across an amazing array of machines, even down to inventing new sort of gunpowder and helicopters and all the rest of it. And di Giorgio took over his book, and then Leonardo took over di Giorgio's book. So, and Leonardo, we know that because in Florence, in the Leonardo Museum, there is di Giorgio's book with Leonardo da Vinci's writing scrawled all over it, all sorts of comments and so on, page after page. So there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever. Now, what I began to wonder is, how on earth did Tacola, who started the whole thing off, how on earth did he get all his ideas? And that's really what led me to this latest book, 1434.
Don't you feel like you're being led down some path? Every question you ask, there's all of these, if you will, like little crumbs leading you to these treasures.
Well, I was amazingly lucky. We just happened to go to Toledo. We just happened to go to this exhibition. And because it was such a sort of abstruse subject, it was really very, very easy to find all manner of clues. Having, as you might say, stumbled upon the fact that Leonardo was not an original thinker, I don't want to decry Leonardo in any way at all. I think he was a genius. but and a fantastic painter, an even more incredible illustrator. But his real skill was not inventing, which he didn't really invent anything as far as I can see, but in developing other people's ideas in a manner which the man in the street could understand. So when he, for example, came across pumps, which were rather crudely drawn by DiGiorgio and Tacola, he could refine them and make 3D drawings, which would be perfectly understandable today. So Leonardo was an absolute genius, and I'm not decrying that. And then when I dug deeper into Tacola, I realized that those people on our website who had said all the way along, I've been too simplistic about Chinese coming to Europe, they're absolutely dead right. And a Canadian, Chinese-Canadian called Taipeng Wang, found records in both China and in Florence that a Chinese delegation had visited the Pope in 1434, who was that year he was in exile in Florence, and they'd brought a whole mass of information with them, including world maps. Now, this got me really interested because I have learned a bit about world maps, and there are all sorts of unfathomable questions that people should ask about world maps. For example, the Library of Congress owns a world map published in 1507 by a man called Waldseemüller, which shows the whole coast of the Americas from 45 degrees north, right up in the north, present Oregon, right down to the Straits of Magellan, as we now call them. In the Library of Congress, there is this map showing all that, which was published before Magellan found the Straits of Magellan, before Ferrelo and Cabrillo reached Oregon and could have described it, before Balboa discovered the Pacific, in inverted commas. So before all these brave explorers found the Americas, there were maps, accurate maps, showing the Americas. So clearly, the people who are credited with finding the Straits of Magellan, that is Magellan himself, is incorrect, because by the time he got down there, 12 years earlier, a map had been published showing the Straits. And I set out in this latest book, 1434, to find that map. And again, I was incredibly lucky. I was invited to give a speech at the biannual conference of geographers in France at a place called Saint-Dié-des-Vosges, in which I did. Well, that was Waldseemüller's hometown, who the chap that produced this map. So I could get hold of all his notes with the blessing of the museum authorities. And I found that, in fact, he was able to produce his map because he'd received from the King of Portugal a world map. And I could then go back to the King of Portugal. How did he get it? He got it from Venice. And how did they get it from there? They got it through the Pope. And the Pope obtained his copies. He's given it by the Chinese. So to summarize, rather for the lengthy explanation, I found out the Chinese came to Florence via Venice, and they brought with them world maps and also all sorts of complex mathematical tables which enabled Chinese navigators to determine latitude and longitude. So they brought the world maps, and they brought the methods the Chinese had used for calculating the shape of the world from their discoveries. And that's all set out in the book, together with copies of the Chinese maps, world maps, which were presented to the Pope, who in his turn sent them to the King of Portugal and to Christopher Columbus. So Columbus essentially had a world map showing him the way to the Americas, which he actually acknowledged. He didn't actually claim to discover the Americas. Magellan had a map showing him the Straits of Magellan, and both Columbus and Magellan's maps were taken from the Chinese world map, which was presented to the Pope in 1434.
I feel like you are the combination Columbo and Inspector Clouseau and James Bond of revisionist history. Very distinguished and eloquent, but really, you've got a tiger by the tail, don't you?
Well, you're very sweet to say that. I think what really has happened is the website has completely changed the historian's profession. And when 1421 was published, Transworld, who I think did a wonderful job on publishing that book, they said, look, you're going to get snowed under with emails, so set up a website and work out a way of coping with the people who come and ask questions and so on. Well, we set up this website virtually the same time as 1421 was published. That's in 2002. And we've had every day we have approximately 2,000 people who come to the website with criticisms or agreements, and above all with new ideas and new evidence. And I've invested my royalties in a team of young people who analyze what comes in, and they try and make sense of it all and then retransmit it. So we've got 13,500 friends on our website who continuously bring us new information.
That's extraordinary.
It is. It's just amazing. It's an incredible facility. It's more. We've got more friends on our website than Oxford or Cambridge universities have undergraduates. I mean, it is an incredible resource. And everything that we publish in the book has been gone over by friends of our website who have come along and said, there's a mistake here, or you've forgotten something, or here's more evidence. So everything just sort of keeps going. It's like a self-perpetuating machine.
Well, I think the key to it is that you're in love with learning, and you're open to seeing who came before and how these connections are made, and putting this together and staying in the verifying process as much as you can. And saying when you think something versus when you verified something. I think that helps.
Well, I wouldn't presume to know an awful lot, which is quite an advantage, because you come upon history with a fairly open mind if you accept you're not an expert, and I have accepted that from the start. So if somebody comes along and says, I've found evidence that people from the papacy have brought a secret document and shown it to King of Portugal or whatever, whereas 10, 15 years ago, I'd have said, oh, for goodness sake, forget it. Now, virtually nothing that comes in do we discard straight away. So we try and cross-reference and analyze what comes in. But a most amazing flow of evidence comes in the whole time. So if I can take one example.
Please.
In the book 1434, I set out how the Chinese and then the Europeans were able to calculate latitude without sextants and longitude without clocks.
You went into great detail about that, astronomy and navigation, and I think you should talk about that.
Right. Well, essentially, the book 1434, I refer to the mathematical tables which the Chinese brought to Florence in 1434. And I showed how they used those tables and the star tables and star charts to calculate longitude, and how their work was taken over by, first of all, a man called Regiomontanus, and then Copernicus and Galileo. So the mathematical tables were of great importance in enabling Renaissance mathematicians and astronomers to realize that the Earth was not the center of the universe, that the Sun was, and the Earth was a planet amongst many, and circled the Earth. So I could show that Copernicus actually got his knowledge from the Chinese. Now, the reason I say that is that when that's all put in the book and then appears on the website, you get people who come along and say, well, hold on a moment. You say the Chinese could calculate latitude and longitude with these mathematical tables, but why don't you go further back, see who else could before the Chinese? So I thought, well, okay, I'll try. And I did. I investigated, went further and further back, and I found, to my astonishment, that, in fact, the Babylonian astronomers could calculate longitude certainly by 650 BC, Right, probably by 750 BC and possibly by 1600 BC. So some 3,000 years before Copernicus and Galileo, and indeed before the Chinese, the Babylonians from Mesopotamia had accurate star tables which enabled them to calculate latitude and longitude and therefore sail to different parts of the world if they had the capacity and return in safety. Now, that all of that knowledge came from friends of our website. And as I gradually picked up the story, which I've put into a third book called Lost Treasures of Atlantis, about Babylonian and Mesopotamian astronomy, we've had help all the way along the line from the people on our website. So all three of my books have been collective endeavors. We've relied heavily all the way through on continuous corrections, advice, disagreement and agreement and new evidence from people in 130 countries across the world who visit our website basically almost every day.
So really the website is a receptive vehicle for continuous discovery.
It's very, very important, incredibly useful. Of course, you know, one gets nutters who, but then they're pretty easy to sort out because others will do it for you. So if somebody comes along and says the Pope's a woman and produces evidence that he says shows that, we could put that up on and it would be destroyed in about 20 minutes. From a barrage of people saying them so utterly ridiculous. So it's an incredibly important tool and one which, as I say, in my view, will revolutionize history and the profession of history.
I wonder why it is that once we find out this amount of evidence for something, Gavin, why won't school books for kids get changed?
I think it takes time. If you go down and see what happened with 1421... now it's on sale in 130 countries in 41 editions. And it's selling as well now as it did when it was published 8 years ago. So gradually the message gets through. And I get invited to talk at universities and conferences and things. And that they're usually reported. And that, again, means the message does get put abroad, as one might say. So it's just, I think one has to be patient. And I think it's fair to say you can't possibly expect historians who spent their lives, say, describing Columbus' voyage to the Americas, whether he passed north or south of a particular sandbank, and then they learn it's all irrelevant anyway, because he had a map, and he also had a contract in his pocket with the King of Spain, and he was going to be Viceroy of America. He wasn't going to discover anything because they knew it's already there.
I guess my question is, why is history told the way it's told then? Who is telling the history?
Well, I think one must expect a great deal of stubbornness in that, again, if you're a professor of history, and you've been teaching this stuff, relying on, say, Chinese scholars for a certain amount of information, and you don't want to readily admit it's all you've been teaching nonsense. And there's people's reputations, their pensions, their school fees for their children, and so on. So I think, basically, the man in the street is very, very shrewd, receptive, and sensible. And they're the people who are going to change history in the end. Because they'll start saying, well, now why is my children being taught? Why are they being taught Columbus discovered America? And it's perfectly obvious he didn't. Why are they being taught Magellan discovered the Straits of Magellan when it's obvious he had a map showing him the Straits before he got there? So eventually it will all get changed, but we just have to be patient and keep going.
Do you think it'll happen in your lifetime?
No, I don't. I'm 73, and I think it'll take 20 years or so, probably.
Well, I want you to be alive to see it. So you better stay well.
Well, the second wave of books has come out. A number of books have followed mine about different aspects of the story. For example, The Discovery of America. A scientist called Dr. S.L. Lee, who is a professor and an academic, who was quite a critic of my book, 1421, he found by complete chance a medallion buried in Asheville, North Carolina, which was a power of attorney given by the Xuan De Emperor, that's the emperor who was in power in China in 1431 to 1436. And this power of attorney authorizes the holder to act on his behalf. Now, it appeared to Dr. Lee that the only people who would have such a power of attorney from the Chinese emperor were seafarers who had reached North Carolina in 1434. So he started research into the background to this medallion, and he found that the local peoples of that part of North Carolina have all sorts of links with China. For example, their flag is the same as the Admiral Zheng He's flag.
Wow.
They make very fine pottery. Their DNA has Chinese or East Asian admixture, and so on. So he has just presented all this evidence at a conference in Malacca, and he's written a book, which he hopes is going to be published soon. Another major book has come out from a lady called Charlotte Harris Rees, who inherited a lot of Chinese maps from her father, and they're maps of the Americas. And they go right back to 200 BC. So she has put all these maps in a book, and she can show that Chinese had been exploring long before Admiral Zheng He. And they'd been back and forth to the Americas for 2,000 years. So that's the second major book.
By the way, we did do an interview with her, and I did read her book and saw it on your site. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, now, a third really major book is that Zheng He's diaries, the Admiral Zheng He, who commanded Chinese fleets between 1405 and 1434, his diaries have been found, and they've been translated by two American professors called Mark and Laurie Nicholas. And the diaries describe his voyage from Alexandria, that's
Egypt,
where the on the North Egyptian coast, major port. He sailed from the Mediterranean port of Alexandria westwards across the Mediterranean to Carolinas, and he describes getting there and the city of Cahokia as it was in 1434. And so these diaries of Zheng He are, in my view, very, very interesting. They will be published in a few months' time. And so people will say, well, you know, hold on. If the Admiral, Chinese Admiral, got to the Americas in 1434, how come we say Columbus discovered the Americas?
Are you saying 1434 or 1421?
1434.
Okay.
And then there's the book by Paul Chiasson, which describes an Asian base which he's found on a promontory near his home, a place called Cape Dauphin, in the northeast part of Canada. And his book has been published and is a bestseller in Canada. So there's a storm of controversy surrounding that book. So that's just four books. There's actually about another dozen which are in the process of being published. So I think fairly soon, the mainstream, it'll change from the moment traditional historians are in the substantial majority, and people like myself are a minority. it will soon change to being 50-50. And then I think the traditional historians will be in the minority. Another very, very important book is published by a man called Liu Gang, who owns a Chinese map of the world produced under the auspices of Admiral Sheng He, first published in 1418, which shows the whole world, including the Americas, accurately drawn, including Australia and New Zealand, and so on. So he, in publishing his map, has obviously created a furore in China. And CCTV, Central Chinese Television, did a broadcast on his map. And then they asked the Chinese audience, which is about a billion, whether they believed that this was a genuine Chinese map of the world. And the audience were split down the middle. So literally hundreds of millions of Chinese now know what their admirals did and how far they explored and the maps they made. And that, in effect, will in time have quite an impact, I think.
Gavin, isn't there a forensics to map making? Is there some way to verify the forensics if it's an original map or a copied map? And what about dating them?
We had the map dated. Dating really only is as good as the paper. So you can have a map whose paper is dated to 1418. But in fact, it's a forgery because somebody else has written in ink on top of the old paper, if you follow.
Okay.
So actually, dating doesn't work. Well, now, I think I can probably answer your question by saying what the critics, how they reacted when this map was published.
Please do.
Obviously, well, when Liu Gang, first of all, how did Liu Gang find this map? This map, he is a distinguished lawyer. He set up what is now China's second largest law firm. He's the founding partner. He's not the sort of person who would produce a forged map. If he did so and he was found out, it would be the end of his career, obviously. The provenance is very, very good. Now, he's been collecting maps and valuables, works of art, for a long, long time. And he found this map, world map, showing the Americas, dated 1418, in a small bookseller's in Shanghai. And he could see it was very, very old. It had wormholes and God knows what in the paper. So he bought it and he took it to Christie's and they said, yes, it's genuine. Well, he then decided he'd got a very, very valuable map. He wrote to six Chinese cartographers and said, here we are. This is what I've got. What do you think? And not one of these six bothered to reply to him. So he then sent the map to me, and I thought, Marcel and my wife said, you know, this is just too good to be true. You're being set up. It confirms everything you said. So for God's sake, you know, don't embrace it. Act with the utmost caution. Well, I decided I'd go and have a look at the map, and I was convinced for a whole mass of reasons it was genuine. Now, what we then decided to do is publicize this map, he in China and me in the rest of the world, he on January the 16th and me on January the 17th, 2007. And we went and did that. And The Economist decided to run a big story, and they did so and published pictures of the map. And basically, we got thousands and thousands of reports in newspapers, magazines and articles of various sorts across the world. So huge, huge publicity about this Chinese world map dated 1418, when it was original. Now, the critics were furious. You can imagine, you know, it appeared I was dead right. So they issued a stream of reasons why the map was a forgery. And they said their argument can be boiled down to the fact that they said that there were a lot of words on this map which were not in use in China in 1418. For example, the writing, the Chinese writing, is simplified. And they said Mao Zedong brought simplified writing in 1949. And because the maps got simplified writing, which only came in 1949, it's obviously a fake. And they argued that there were a number of words, considerable number of words, that were also fakes, because the Ming people did not use them in the early 15th century. Well, we analyzed all these comments, and we had our own experts, and they were correct in a way, the critics, in that a lot of the words were not in use. But what they'd forgotten was that China's an empire of peoples, doesn't have just one people. And the scholars who'd said these words were not in use were Han scholars, traditional Chinese. They were not the people from the minority areas of China. And in fact, every single word that they said was not in use actually was in use, but in Yunnan, the province in southwest China, which borders Burma. And not only were the words in use in Yunnan, but we could show that the cartographer must have been an Islamic cartographer who'd actually been based in Quanzhou in China, because there were certain alliterations and phrases which were only used by these people who were originally Muslims and who set up cartographic base in Quanzhou. So we could show everything actually was in use, including simplified Chinese. They were quite wrong about it first appearing under Mao Zedong in 1949. That is a fable which Mao Zedong put about, that he brought in simplified writing that everyone could read. In fact, absolute nonsense. It's been in use in China for 1,000 years before Mao Zedong. So we the critics, in fact, consolidated and reinforced our views that this map is absolutely dead genuine. Well, critics, as you can imagine, mostly the Chinese critics, were very, very upset by all this. And the Chinese government, the story moves on, the Chinese government decided they wanted to build a new harbour for Olympic sailing when they hosted the Games. And they built this beautiful yacht harbour near Quanzhou. And they wanted to have statues of the great seafarers of the past, Zheng He, Magellan, Columbus, and Captain Cook. So they decided that these statues would be unveiled in the ceremony, which they'd asked the ambassadors of all the countries to which Zheng He had sailed. So there was the Egyptian ambassador, African ambassadors, and so on and so on. They then asked who should make speeches at the inauguration of this port and the statues, and they invited several Chinese cartographic scholars, and they also invited myself, which was a great honor, and Liu Gang, who owned the 1418 map. So they said to me, if you were invited, would you come? And I said, of course I could. Would I be very, very honored to give a talk there? And everything got screwed up because the Chinese cartographer said, well, if Gavin Menzies and Liu Gang are going to be there, no way we're going to share a platform. So you choose who you want to make the speeches, Renegades, Menzies and Liu Gang, or us. And the Chinese government said, well, thank you very much. We'll have Menzies and Liu Gang. So I feel that was an utterly extraordinary moment. It's as if Nelson's statue in Trafalgar Square was being unveiled, and the Chinese naval officer was asked to give the speech. It's ridiculous.
So you did give speeches, correct?
Yeah. Liu Gang and I were the only two. The others wouldn't refuse to appear. So we gave the speeches. So the Chinese government obviously have decided that it is a genuine map, and therefore the Chinese admiral had discovered the entire world including the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, the Arctic, the Antarctic, by 1418.
I want you to talk a little bit about your time in Egypt and on your chapter on the Nile and the Red Sea. And I also wanted to ask you, in there you said that the Chinese imported huge quantities of frankincense, and I was wondering why. Do you know why?
No, I don't.
I'm fascinated with why. At some point, if you ever find out, I would love to know.
Probably Buddhist ceremonies, is my guess, but I will find out.
Yeah.
And let you know. We use our website, so I'll do that tomorrow.
That would be great. I want you to talk about the Nile and the Red Sea as transportation routes. Yeah. Talk about that.
Certainly. The Nile and the Red Sea have been connected by canals for thousands of years. I lay out the sort of sequence of events, which pharaoh started and so on. Basically, the Nile floods after the rains in Central Africa. It floods every year, and it carries down huge quantities of silt and deposits this silt on the low land between Cairo and the Delta. So that's where the canal, the various canals linking the Nile and the Red Sea have been dug on the lowland, which is a perfectly sensible route. However, the problem is that every year or so, silt brought down chokes the canal. So it's been an endless exercise. Once the canal was dug out in about 1700 BC, it's had to be redug and cleaned dozens, if not hundreds of times since then. So the critics jumped up and down with joy, saying, oh, well, we found that the canal was shut in the year 648. So it couldn't have been opened when Zheng He fleet passed down it, or these smaller ships passed down. And they thought they had a field day. Well, I've spent quite some time, actually, there, walking through the canal, alongside the canal, which branches eastward from the Nile, north of Cairo, about 30 miles north of East Cairo, at a place called Zagazig. It branches eastwards, and it joins the Red Sea in just shortly after the Bitter Lakes. Now, you can walk that today, which I've done. Of course, it doesn't mean to say that because the canal's in use today, it was in use in Zheng He's time, so I accept that. Well, we had a very interesting email from a friend of our website about a year ago, and he said, I've just matched Google with Napoleon's maps. Now, when Napoleon conquered Egypt in 1798, he decided that he would do a survey of the land. Basically, the fellaheen, the Egyptian farmers and peasants, were continuously finding their land flooded with silt, and it was a hell of a job to find out who owned what. So there was a lot of dissatisfaction, huge number of border disputes from one farmer's land to another. Napoleon decided he'd get rid of all that by doing a cadastral survey, which he carried out over 2 years, and he took that back to Paris with him, where this friend of the website actually saw it, and he matched up with Google Earth, and he was able to show that the canal which Napoleon charted is still in use today. You can actually see the water on Google Earth entering the canal just north of Cairo. Well, that, of course, shows that it was still there in Napoleon's time, but it doesn't show it's there in Zheng He's time. However, the fascinating thing is that one of the pharaohs, Al-Nasim, in about 1330, between 1320 and 1330, he dug a new part of the canal through northern Cairo, and that's the part which is still, which Napoleon charted, and which can be seen today on Google. So with this evidence, you can show that the same canal was actually there in 1330 as it was there time of Napoleon and today. So it's real. And it was very, very useful, as you say. Now, the problem was that it was flooded with silt after the annual floods, about every second or third year. So it could part of the year when it was silted up, it couldn't be used. You had to clean it out and so on. The second disadvantage of it was that boats had to be flat-bottomed, so Zhonghe's monster ships couldn't possibly use it. It's only for smaller ships. But it's still there. I'm talking to the Egyptian government at the moment to see whether we can set up an exhibition showing the use of the canal in various stages back 2,000 years and how incredibly useful it's been.
Isn't this one of the routes that interpreters and dignitaries came from different countries?
Zhonghe set up an interpreter school. The Chinese Admiral Zhonghe, who sailed the world from 1405 to 1434 with huge, huge fleets, he set up an interpreter school in Nanjing. And the Chinese fleets had on board interpreters who could converse in 17 languages, not only Egyptian, but Latin, to deal with the Pope and speak to the Pope and his representatives, and so on. So China and Egypt have had a long, long trade relationship going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, which is evidenced by the absolutely massive halls of blue and white ceramics of the early Ming era, which have been found in Fushtat, that's the port in southern Cairo. So there are literally shiploads full of very valuable ceramics, which you can also, of course, see in Egyptian museums. So Egypt and China have been trading partners since several hundred years before BC.
And this is also how a lot of information, including maps and findings and discoveries, could be communicated back and forth.
You're absolutely right. The Egyptians, all through the Middle Ages, demanded that any ships using the Red Sea Nile Canal and berthing as Alexandria had to deposit their maps with the authorities in Alexandria, and they were taken away and copied and then given back. So all ships passing through Alexandria had to leave their maps and navigational records. And that, as you rightly say, produced an enormous trawl. Well, you can go further than that, because the Chinese who passed to Alexandria then went on to Venice, and they deposited, they showed their maps in Venice to the Italians, which is why a whole stream of Venetian maps have appeared through the centuries, which show parts of the world on these maps before Europeans reached those parts. So, for example, a Venetian called Zatta drew maps of the Bering Straits before Bering got there and before Vancouver got to Vancouver Island. He drew Vancouver Island, and he wrote on his map, Colony of Chinese Peoples. Another cartographer in the early 16th century drew beautiful maps of South America, in which he said, these are the cities of Chinese silk, and he published it before Pizarro got there. Tiziano published maps of the Caribbean before Columbus set sail. The cartographer De Verga published in 1419 a map of the Eastern Hemisphere, which showed Australia, South America. Sorry, it didn't show South America. It showed Australia and the Eastern Hemisphere as far as China, including rivers which the Chinese didn't which the Europeans didn't reach for another 100 years. So this 1419 map, which de Verga published, was a copy of Schoenherr's 1418 map. And it shows exactly the same things as Schoenherr's 1418 map. It shows South Africa, the correct shape, 50 years before Europeans reached South Africa. It shows islands in the Indian Ocean 100 years before Europeans discovered them. It shows Northern Australia 300-odd years before Captain Cook and so on. So that's why Venetians have always been in the driving seat, because they were long-established trading partners of China.
I noticed you also said that there were thousands of Asian slave girls ended up in Venice as well from Alexandria.
There were. You can show the huge trading relationship between Venice and China going back hundreds and hundreds of years in the baptismal records of medieval Venice. So if you go see to whom were the babies born in the hospitals in the 1440s, a very high percentage is Asian children who were the sons and daughters of slaves which were brought by ship from China to Venice.
Remember when I asked you what was the book that Leonardo had seen these pictures or illustrations of inventions? What I thought I was referring to was the Nongshu.
The Nongshu is a Chinese book. It's the book from which Takala copied this mass of machines. And it was published, I've got the exact date here. It was published in 1313, and the Chinese versions were destroyed in various uprisings, Boxer Uprising and so on. But fortunately, parts of this book have turned up in the British Library in London and in the Asian Library in Cambridge and in Chicago. So quite a bit of the book has survived. And basically, it's a book about machines. It was the first printed book, as far as anyone knows. And what I argue in 1434 is that that was the book from which Takala drew his machines. And Di Giorgio then improved upon Takala, and Leonardo da Vinci improved further, substantially improved on Di Giorgio's work. So I lay out the evidence in my book, 1434, that the Nongshu was, in fact, the basis for a very large number of Leonardo's much better drawings of machines.
It was about agriculture and agriculture engineering as well, correct?
Exactly that, absolutely. So I summarize Leonardo's work. He really based it on a vast amount of work done by Di Giorgio and Takala, who based their work on this Chinese book, the Nongshu, published in 1313. And he also based his parachute on Di Giorgio's, his helicopter on Takala's, and his books and works on perspective on Alberti's De Pictura and De Statua. So really, I say that, if I could summarize what I wrote in the book, Leonardo's three-dimensional illustrations of the components of man and machines are a unique and brilliant contribution to civilization, as are his sublime sculptures and paintings. But none of it was an original invention. Is based on the work of others.
Are you familiar with people inventing things in different parts of the world during the same time window, where someone comes up with an idea for something and then somehow in a parallel universe, and that idea realm comes to these people in completely different parts of the world, but they don't know each other and they don't know what came to each other? But my question to you in this context, though, of sometimes things coming in completely different parts of the world at the same time, but nobody knows, right? How does that in context relate to the evidence for who was the original? Doesn't it expand the thought of what is original? Because if that happens in that case, in that particular case, something showed up simultaneously to people who were maybe receptive or sitting around who put a conclusion together, then who was the original?
That's undoubtedly true, what you say. But what I really argue, I think, is that in my book, 1434, if you draw a line, 1434, when the Chinese arrived, and you put before 1434 the various inventions that Alberti, Toscanelli, Fontana, Tacola, Reggio Montanus, and DiGiorgio produced, all the discoveries and inventions, there's virtually nothing, absolutely nothing happened before 1434. Then after 1434, there's just a massive amount of every sort of invention, new evidence, astronomy, mathematics, algebra, painting, sculpture, inventions of machines, torquetums, and God knows what. Huge, huge volume of stuff. And so much came between 1434 and 1470. But I think one can perfectly legitimately argue, yes, there might have been inventions in other parts of the world, but not on that scale, not 50, 60, 100 different ideas and inventions which suddenly came, hit everyone with force in the 30 or 40 years after 1434. So, for example, in that period, you have for the first time Europeans appreciating that the solar system, the sun, is the center and not the earth, with all that implies. You have a whole lot of work on comets, forerunner of Kepler. You have forerunner of Newton in the gravitational field of Copernicus, of Galileo, and goodness knows how many new inventions, new pumps, military machines, guns, bazookas, mortars, machine guns, underwater missiles and projectiles. I mean, it's just amazing explosion. Now, I can show that every single one of the new military and civil machines had appeared in Chinese drawings, most of them, in this one book, which we've talked about. So I say it's just too much to put it all down to.
Got it. Before we close today, there's so much information in 1421, but also in 1434. So much information. The level of detail. I mean, if somebody is not interested to know the level of detail and how the dots connect, context in which things are emerging and synchronistic things that have happened, yeah, then don't read it. But if you're interested to really know the full detail, you get it, which I think is extraordinary. You speak about Robert Cribbs.
Yes.
And you spoke a little bit about declination and the stars, yes, at the very beginning of this show.
Yes.
But Robert Cribbs influenced your understanding in something. I want you to share it with us.
Right. Well, what I tried to do is make, as you say, a pretty complex argument with a whole mass of evidence into something which an ordinary person like myself could read. So, to use a sort of vulgar term, the white van driver, people who rely on manual work to make their living. We tried to make the book readable to them. Now, this requires a hell of a lot of expert help. Got to find experts who not only know exactly what they're talking about, but they can put it over in a way which I can understand, and therefore just about anyone can understand. And Robert Cribbs is one of these. He's a very, very clever man. Set up all sorts of private companies which produced new inventions and made a pile of money. And then he's also a professor of music and professor in several universities, including in Egypt and in America. So he's a sort of Renaissance man. He can do just about anything. And he got really interested in helping me. And he's a really wonderful support because he could show perfectly logical ways in which people could calculate longitude and latitude without longitude about clocks and latitude about sextants. And he built a model to test it, and it worked. And so he was absolutely invaluable to me. Now, sadly, he just quite suddenly died. Just like that. And just before 1434 went to the publishers. So he never saw the book, but he's been an incredible help to me.
After I read the work that he did and his influence with you, I was led to ask you about him. He talked about the 23-hour, 56-minute day.
that's exactly right. So he essentially, just his brilliance, I think, was he pointed out to me that if there is a unique event in the sky, which everyone on Earth can see at the same time, like a lunar eclipse, then the different signs which different observers see that unique event is a direct correlation of their difference in longitude. So, for example, if the eclipse is seen by an astronomer in Beijing at sunset, and it's seen by the observer in the Indian Ocean 6 hours after sunset, then the observer in the Indian Ocean is 6 hours difference in longitude, or 6 hours out of 24 hours, which is one quarter, which is 90 degrees in longitude, being one quarter of 360 degrees. So what has to be done is to have a timing device which will time between sunset and, say, 8 hours later. And that timing device could be a water clock, drips of water coming out of something, receptacle. And in fact, a number of professors, Professor J.M. Steele being one, have found that the Babylonians in 1600 BC, I think, might have been a bit later than that, but they had these water clocks of sufficient accuracy to be able to calculate longitude through observing eclipses. Well, now, Bob Cribbs explained all that to me so simply, I could put it in the book and virtually everyone would understand it. But if I could just take it a bit further than that, it's a general point. Books, popular history books, people think they're very easy to write. I find them incredibly difficult to write because publishers are very, very concerned about their reputations. And if you write a controversial history book, you can expect, quite reasonably, heavy flack from academics who do know their subject inside out. So the more controversial the book is, the more you have to check and double-check facts. So it is to publish a book like 1421 or 1434 is a very, very expensive business for a publisher. For example, over 100 people worked on 1421. In one way or another, from illustrations, approvals.
Gorgeous illustrations, sales. Too.
Sorry?
Yeah, it's a gorgeously packaged book as well, both of them.
Well, thank you. But, I mean, it is very, very expensive. And then you really haven't got a clue whether people are going to buy it or not. It's the whole thing is just a huge gamble. But I must confess, I've been incredibly impressed by publishers. They've all got guts, and they'll, you know, they, if they believe in something, they'll have a go. Very heartening.
In The Lost Treasures of Atlantis, the manuscript is done, correct? And it's being prepared for the public. When do you think we'll be able to read that?
Well,
next year?
next year, yes, but I'm not sure when. I think probably August. The manuscript is, they paid me for the manuscript. It's now being the copy editor who has to hand it in on October the 12th, at which stage the timetable is laid down, but I'm reasonably sure it will be August next year.
What made you tackle Atlantis?
It was a complete accident. What really happened is I went to America with a group of research friends to see when the Chinese first went to America. Was it 1600 BC or 400 BC or when? And we found the answer, and when I got home, I was convinced I was going to have a stroke, so I worked like a dog and all this down. And I finished the book at Christmas, and I was so tired, I couldn't use my hands. They were locked with arthritis. So Marcella said, look, we'll go away on our own for Christmas. We'll go to a monastery in Crete, and we'll just pray and drink lots of vino and walk by the southern shore of Crete. So we did.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, and on one of these walks, we came across a little harbor, and we said, and where there was a beautiful old palace, and we said, when was this palace built? And they said, 2,500 BC. We said, what? Don't be ridiculous. That's as old as the pyramids. And the guides to this palace said, well, the ships from here sailing back and forth to Egypt in 2,500 BC, that's 4,000 years before Magellan or Da Gama. So I could not believe it. And I said, what's your evidence? And they said, the evidence comes in Pharaoh's tombs, paintings of the Pharaoh's tombs, which show these ships arriving from Crete with gifts to the Pharaohs. Well, I went and looked at the pictures, and then I was amazed. They're really beautiful ships. So we thought, well, we'd better try and find out if there are any been recently found, buried, or on the sea bottom or whatever. And we didn't have much luck because we learned that this civilization called the Minoan civilization, which traded with Egypt, was wiped out by the most ghastly volcanic eruption in 1450 BC, which occurred on an island called Santorini, which is about 70 miles north of Crete. So we thought, okay, well, we'll go to Santorini and see if there are any shipwrecks there. We did. We got a ferry. Off we went to Santorini. And we found that archaeologists had decided to excavate a Minoan town, which was built in roughly 2000 BC on the southern part of Santorini. And by incredible bit of luck, the archaeologists dug down and they found, they came into the drawing room of a very wealthy sea captain, which had been buried in 1450 BC by 50 foot of lava and magma. But when they excavated it, they could see that the paintings around his walls of his palace were in perfect condition, and they showed a fleet of very advanced ships returning to Santorini before 1450 BC when this volcanic eruption had blown the island to bits. This was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I could see at once these ships were crewed by getting on for 100 people. They were much bigger than Columbus's ships, much more advanced than Columbus's ships, and they were 4,000 years before him. Well, was there a wreck? And amazingly, three wrecks have been found on the coast of Turkey, about 150 miles east of Santorini. And because these ships were carrying copper, the copper's reacted with the seawater to preserve the hull. There are no termites and all the rest. So you can see what the shape of the hull was, the size of the ship. And even more important, you can see the goods that were in the ship when she sank in... It was, they can date by dendrochronography of the wood that they sank about 1300 BC. One was slightly older, about 1600 BC. So the contents of the holds of these ships are goods from six different continents. You've got amber from the Baltic, shells from the Maldive Islands, glass from Egypt, and copper, and I'll leave copper for the moment. So these ships, you can say for sure, traded all over the world. And that's really what my book's about. I decided that I'd visit everywhere where the goods in the wreck came from. So I go to the Baltic and see if there's evidence of the ships trading in the Baltic. I go to Britain and see whether there was evidence of the tin they carried and so on and so forth. And that is the book.
You really do walk your talk, don't you?
Well, we were incredibly lucky. An amazing series of strokes of luck. And it is a very, very controversial book. But strangely, there's a whole mass of heavyweights who will support it.
What has gone on in Egypt and anything ancient, many, many people are getting a reinvigorated interest in ancient civilizations.
Yes, I agree with you. There's been a very good program here in London put on by the British Museum called History of the World in 100 Objects. So they take 100 objects and they illustrate their era and what happened in that era and why the objects were made and so on. Hugely popular, as you say.
What is the part of your life right now that's weighing heavily on you at this time of your life to accomplish?
Surviving, really, to see the book through to publication. It's, you know, just hope and muddle through to the next day.
Are you in good health?
Not particularly, no.
Well, maybe we should open up your website to people who can assist you, because you need to stay well. You need to stay alive and well.
Oh, well.
You know, there was a very famous doctor, Dr. Batmanji, who was from Iran, who did a 30-year study of hydration.
Yes.
And how hydration is deeply connected to all diseases, the beginnings of all diseases. And
really?
So we want to say to you to please stay very hydrated. 50% of your body weight divided by 2 is the number of liquid ounces of water that you should be drinking a day, pure water.
Good Lord, is that right?
Yes. And that's how you keep your basic hydration intact. You have to add another glass of water for any coffee or tea that you drink because it dehydrates.
What about beer?
Beer, I don't know, but just make sure that you drink plenty of water. So how is Marcella doing with this entire adventurous life with you? And what does she want in the next coming time?
Well, she finds it very, very interesting. And we both realize how unbelievably lucky we've been. So I hope she keeps in good health. We'll get this book finished and then do a revised 1421. And then I think that'll be that.
Well, I'm going to come see you and your wife in London. We have some talking to do about discovery.
Yeah, we'd love to see you. That's yes, a great indeed. Pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to, learning from, and listening to Gavin Menzies, the New York Times best-selling author of 1421, the year China discovered America. And today we've also been talking about 1434, the year a magnificent Chinese fleet sailed to Italy and ignited the Renaissance. Please pick up these books. It'll completely alter your sense of history. It'll bring a renewed excitement and invigoration into the realm of discovery. And next year, be on the lookout for The Lost Treasures of Atlantis. Gavin Menzies, thank you so much for being our guest. We hope you'll come back again, whether you have another book after Atlantis or not.
Right.
And I look forward to meeting you and your wife in London this year.
Thank you very much for inviting me to my great interview.
Thank you. Many, many blessings and thanks for all of your work.